The following episode is brought to you by Poison City Brewing, proud makers of Durban Poison Cannabis Lager, the beer that invites you to live your poison.
Christian, how are you? How's your day been so far?
No, well, it's been busy, but can't complain. How are you guys?
I'm pretty good. I've been excited for this today. So, Christian, can you just start off by telling us a little bit about your projects? We know that you have Stain IP, which is backing Fame, and that is a non-profit organization. So give us the juice.
Okay, well, Stain IP is an intellectual property and legal compliance law firm, which I started with another director earlier in this year. And we focus on, well, it says it all, IP, intellectual property. So that's our main business, is the law firm on the one side. But what we have that's, I think, more relevant to your listeners is fame.org.za, which is the foundation for the advancement of musicians' empowerment. And what that is it's a non-profit organization dedicated to giving free, no strings attached, pro bono assistance to musicians on copyright and contractual law. So even though the non-profit is supported by the law firm, it is not officially associated with the law firm. It is entity completely on its own. It's actually been running for more than a year, the nonprofit already, and that nonprofit is supported by our law firm as well as other law firms specializing in contractual law and IP, and an array of other service providers and just genuinely nice companies and people that are in support of advancing musicians and musicianship in South Africa. So I hope that gives you a bit of information about the two. I don't think your listeners would be too concerned about the law firm side of it, because law firm is a law firm. And when you start talking too much law, people get bored and their eyes glaze over.
You know, you've actually sparked my interest when you mentioned, you know, like a law firm and stuff, because, you know, working in court myself, I'm not a lawyer, but, you know, I work around a lot of lawyers that come through. So you've got the people doing the criminal law and your civil law and whatnot, and it basically keeps the courts busy on a daily basis. Now, when I look at, you know, what Fame is trying to do in terms of, you know, assisting artists and whatnot, and, you know, the contractual law and whatnot, how busy would you guys say it gets? Like, do you guys get enough cases that this is something that can be sustainable in South Africa?
Well, for the law firm side, yeah, we're busy. We don't touch ground when it comes to contracts and IP and court cases and things like that. But for that, our clients aren't just musicians or creators. We've got bigger type industries that are, well, we call it litigation heavy, where you go in and out of court quite often. But our firm it's not just going to court. There's an array of other services that keeps us busy, which is actually a simpler way of making money and staying afloat than going to court every single day, like you would have in a civil firm or a criminal law firm. But when it comes to Fame and musicians dealing with these legal things, we noticed that musicians don't have the money to actually take or to get an attorney or to go to court and fight any of these contractual disputes or IP infringement matters. So it's busy, and staying afloat there, we would say, as long as we can help people, we don't care about anything else on the Fame side. The intention there is not to make money at all. It intention there is to help musicians. And the nice thing is with the support we've got from, like I said, an array of service providers, including our own law firm, we can actually facilitate these legal, contractual and IP issues for musicians extremely cost effectively, because in essence, you don't have costs if you are your own attorney, if that makes sense. So it's really something that we are passionate about, and the people involved and the attorneys involved in the FAME organization side of things really does it for the love of it. And they offer up their time and expertise because they have a passion for music. So the law firm is fine. It stays afloat. It does well. And FAME will always be there because we don't have many expenses and we don't need an income. We are literally just there to help.
So I need a little bit of assistance in terms of connecting some dots right here. Okay, so I know our listeners can't see it, but in your background, there is a nice wall of beautiful guitars. And there's this passion coming through for music and the industry and your willingness to help for free. So I think I'm actually going to draw on one of our listener questions. Shout out to Threes and Sevens for sending this one in. But what motivated you in starting Stain IP and FAME?
Oh, well, I think a bit of history on me personally would give listeners some clarity there. I did not study law to start out with. I actually studied engineering and got like-minded people, and you started a band. And luckily, we had some success in the MK era of the South African music scene in Afrikaans rock music. And we did fairly, I wouldn't say we were the biggest band, but we did okay. And we had shared stages with some amazing, well-known artists. And then our music got actually scripted or used in a film. And in that, we did not see a cent of royalties from our music being in this film. And the film was relatively big back then. So we noticed that, oh my word, people take advantage of musicians, and trying to figure out how to fight and trying to get what is due to us, we noticed it's going to cost us more money to get an attorney to fight this for us than we would have gotten from the royalties. So we just had to let go. In the interim, I dropped out of studying engineering, and I decided, hey, no, let's try a law. It's easier, or I thought it was easier, but I liked the idea of law more. And then I realized IP is something that I'm actually interested in, especially entertainment law and copyright. So I started focusing my studies more on that. Unfortunately, the band dissolved after that incident. So I studied law, went into IP, and then more and more of my musical friends started saying that there's this issue. They've got an issue with this. The contract stated this and they didn't understand that. They can't get their royalties out of these films. This person started using this song and gets music, gets all the royalties, although they wrote it. Things like that. So I decided to help like musicians, more my friends that are musicians, out on copyright things. And I noticed that, look, there's a need for people in the creative industry as a whole to have this access to legal support, but need it free of charge, or at least extremely affordable, because musicians don't have money to pay attorney's fees. That's the fact of it, because musicians don't get paid enough in South Africa, look, there's exceptions, but the majority of musicians don't earn well enough to pay thousands of rands to attorneys. And I then thought, okay, let me formalize this and start FAME. I played around with names, but it ended up being fame.org.za. And we were able to help a lot of musicians in the beginning, but people that just stumbled across us, people we met more, our friends. And then with the lockdown, we noticed that there is an extreme need for this all of a sudden, because all the shows and all the live shows moved online. And now with doing online live shows, the copyright implications and the legal implications on that, just not a lot of people understood it in the musical scene, because now I do covers and Facebook blocks my session midway through, things like that. So we had this explosion of interest in musicians contacting us and saying, what should I do? How does this work? How does that work? And we just said, okay, well, this is the perfect time. Everybody's sitting at home. Everyone is involved or is nailed to their screens, looking for entertainment, finding new artists. Let's take advantage of that and push fame and push the education behind entertainment law, copyright and contracts to musicians, and just try and assist on that front where people actually are now more able to listen due to the unfortunate lockdown and things like that and the impact it had on the music industry. And during that time, I was actually working for the Intellectual Property Office of South Africa in the beginning of the lockdown. And with Fame doing so well, I say doing so well, being able to help so many people, I just noticed that this is what I love. So I resigned at the IP office and I said, well, I'm going to start my own law firm, because then I can focus on what I want to focus on. Obviously, you need to do your work, get your clients, make a living from law firm, but law firm and Fame is very creative industry based. You'll see on our law firm on the Stain IP site, we focus a lot on the creative industry or creativeness. And we always try and get more involved in that on that side. So where Fame is purely just a support platform, Stain IP, the law firm, then enabled us to now go a step further and say, well, should one of these musicians need that extra step, that okay, great, you now need to litigate, or you now need something a bit more than what a nonprofit can offer, we can work together. We can have the nonprofit and the law firm. Again, it's two separate entities. Fame, the nonprofit, has, I'm one of the members in the nonprofit, but there's a group of directors or members running it. So I'm not on my own there. And with Stain IP, I'm also not the only director. So we have this opportunity to support the nonprofit, and the nonprofit has access to official legal support without needing to pay for it. So the two things just naturally, it was a natural development as a result of COVID-19. And that's actually what it was. I always thought about doing my own law firm later on, but the lockdown just forced everything to fall into place for me to say, well, now or never.
You know, I really like what you said there in terms of the effect that lockdown had. You know, it sort of gave you that push. And you can also relate. Like, I feel like even in the creative industry as a whole, like, you know, people sort of woke up and were like, you know, let's just go for everything. And the one thing that really interests me as well, what you were saying right in the beginning when you were talking about artists, you know, being able to help artists in terms of what you do. You know, what would you say, like, looking at the issues that you've dealt with and artists that have come with to you, what would you say is the most common sort of mishap or the most common sort of problem that these artists sort of encounter and decide, hey, you know what, I need your assistance?
The most common thing we saw is artists signing away their rights in their own music just for the sake of signing an agreement or signing a deal and then regretting it afterwards. That's definitely the most common issue we see. And second to that, and following closely to that, is artists going into, collaboration, if I can put it like that, or partnering or dealing with people without having proper agreements in place. Now there's an issue because now somebody's had success and the other one is bitter about it, or that they misused each other's IP and there wasn't any formal arrangement between the two. And now there's an issue and they need to fight about who's getting what and you stole this. So that's the two things. People just signing agreements for the sake of it and people not signing agreements where agreements are necessary. That's the main two things. We had a lot of queries about people wanting to understand copyright and how copyright works and what the difference is between how it works when I cover a song, when I post a song online, things like that, and how royalty distribution and monetary values and things like that. But our main issues came down to contract law. That's usually where you get, pardon how I'm going to state this, but screwed over in the industry is on contracts.
Yeah, and you know, just sort of to expand on what you were saying, I don't want to lose track. When you mentioned two main issues there. Now, obviously, in order for a law firm or any organization to keep going, you are going to need for people to sort of, I wouldn't say need, but, you know, people sort of have to, you know, encounter certain issues in order for the need, you know, to come to, you know, to arise. But you obviously want to try and prevent that in every way you can. So if you can just sort of, you know, give us some advice, just focusing on those two main issues that you mentioned there. We'll start with the first, you know, artists handing over the rights to their own music and then later regretting it. You know, what should artists sort of be looking out for? How should they go about sort of preventing that?
Well, firstly, they need to understand assignment. So, for instance, you sign with a publisher or you sign with a record label. And I'm not saying record labels. I'm not pushing anybody under the bus. I'm just making people aware they are. A lot of times you sign these agreements, there are terms in there that assign your copyright or your ownership in your own music over to them as a whole, meaning they now own it and they can do with it what they want. And they can actually tell you that you're not allowed to sing this online, for instance. We had an instance like that. They can literally... they take ownership of your song and you now just have permission to sing your own song. And if you know what to look for, if you know which words to look for, like assignment, rights, things like that, and you actually read the contract properly, taking into account that I have rights and I should not give this over to somebody without being compensated properly. Because sometimes it's worth giving everything over, but not always. If they know what to look for and they understand the implications of signing or assigning over your rights and your music, then they would be able to say, well, sorry, I just want to read through this properly. And then they can go home, read through it, use Dr. Google for what it's worth. You'll get a lot of American info on there, but you'll get sort of enough info to let you know that, okay, this is not a way to go. Or to send us or other organizations like us the contract and say, hi, guys, just give this a once over. And then if whomever wants you to sign any agreement does not allow you to have somebody look at this, red flag should go up automatically. Because if any person does not want you to have time to read through an agreement, they definitely have something dodgy in that agreement. Then don't sign it. Definitely don't sign it. So musicians should have this thing in the back of their mind that I need time to look through this agreement and insist whenever somebody gives them an agreement to get time to look through this. Don't be forced into signing. And most of the instances we had was that where somebody got an agreement put in front of them and they signed it by just briefly scanning through it and trusting what the other party said. Because the other party obviously tells you all the good things and does not necessarily tell you the negative aspects of the agreement. Or I say negative, the implications of the agreement. So just understand the basic concept and what you are actually signing into, because that would dictate the rest of your relationship going forward with this entity.
I think you actually summed it up beautifully, man. And then just sort of tackling the second issue real quick before we get onto Meegs as well. You know, how do artists sort of go about, you know, preventing, you know, the second aspect?
Well, firstly, don't just, yeah, we're friends, so we'll be fine. That attitude, although I know a lot of people, especially creators, have this like, no, we're friends, what's going to happen? That is where the problem comes in. You should rather have steer towards that attitude. We're friends. We don't want this to go sour. So let's just put down what we are agreed upon, because then we have a reference document. It does not need to be a formal agreement, just a reference document. I agree this. This is how we'll deal with it. If this song gets published or somebody needs to buy it, or if the band does not work, for instance, who can use the song? How we deal with these aspects of us now collaborating, either on music, either as a band, however you collaborate on something, just formalize in writing what you agreed between you and the rest of the guys, so that there is written proof as reference to go to. Because that's on the second one. If you don't have that signed agreement, that's I refer to a signed agreement previously, but it can just be a formal document that people can say, well, we had this. This is what we agreed to. All of you agreed to this. Here's your signature. Here's the email string where you said, yeah, this is fine. Yeah, this is fine. Yeah, this is fine. It does not always need to be this formal heading legal term agreement, as long as it's clear on what's happening and deals with who owns the rights. Because that's your main thing when it comes to music. If you create music, you create an asset, something that could have money value. And you need to establish who has the rights in that asset you created. Because if you don't, then that's where the problem comes in. We're more than willing to assist musicians if they need clarity on that. We sat with a few bands where they literally just wanted to formalize, guys, we're a band, we write music together. How are we going to deal with the music going forward? And we wrote them, helped them write a 2-page document, just this is how the ownership will work in the music. And it's always a good thing to do, because now you are fine with it going forward. So you don't need to worry about that. You can focus on making it.
We'll be right back.
You still loading them and heating them up with all your single shit you've been dropping. You feel me? Loading them up on. It only takes structure. And you know, just paying attention to the climate of the game.
Yeah.
Know what I mean?
So do your homies got a role in your little, you mean?
Yeah, we all artists over here, man.
Y'all
trying,
already?
Yeah, I'm trying to get them on there. Yeah. We all artists, man. We go, you feel me? We gonna have this like,
bro, me and my man Kai, we be like, I don't know, we play with this shit.
Don't
right
play
now.
With this shit.
I gotta lie, we play with this shit right now for real.
Don't play with it.
Don't play with it. Nah. Take that shit serious.
Do musicians have to get to a certain level in their career in order to take the legalities of this seriously, or is it something you'd recommend them to do from the get-go?
This is from the get-go. And the reason I'm saying that is if you make music, you have legal implications on the first song you write. You actually, before you even start writing songs, it's the moment you have a name, there's legal aspects related to the name of your band. Or if you are a single, like a solo artist, there's other rights that and laws that go around and might impact this thing, like your brand as a musician. And if you wait too long, it's sort of too late. It's something you need to have this as priority. Step one, start making music or form a band. Step two, what's the legalities I should look at as to protect myself as a musician? That's one of the most important things to look at. And it doesn't cost you an arm and a leg. Actually, when you start out, just making sure what is copyright, how do I deal with this, what contracts I should look at, what's the impact if somebody has a similar name, and, oh, I want to do cover songs. Am I allowed to actually publish these cover songs? Things like that. You should think of this before you actually start making the music, because you might run into trouble later on, or might think of this too late and then be like, oh no, I had to do this, but this is now too late. So in my view, it's one of the most important things when going into the music, irrespective of what level you are, irrespective of how big you want to be. You can be a weekend warrior like me now, just chuckling music and putting some riffs into other people's recordings and playing violin over someone for an album. Or you can be a full-time musician. This is what I'm going to do. Irrespective of your level of musicianship, and I mean, don't mean that and how good you are, I mean how popular you are, or how well-known you are, your legal standing and the legality surrounding your music and your career as a musician and your business.
Mm-hmm. So could we as musicians ask you to review a contract if we receive one from a label or someone who's maybe commissioning us to do some voiceovers or some score composition? Could we get you to vet them?
That's sort of point number one. If you have an agreement, send it to us. We'll look it over and tell you what's going on or what you should look at, things like that. It's definitely something we urge musicians to do. Mm. And Fame is not the only organization that offers this. There's actually a lot of people out there offering this. There's actually an app for that as well. I saw over the weekend that somebody started developing an app.
Hey, Tune.
Yeah, Tune. That's the
shout out to Burning Group.
Yeah, no, I saw it and I'm like, yeah, brilliant. I'm so glad there's other people doing this, making this accessible for the people. Because to me, the more musicians have the tools available to them to look after their own rights, the happier I am. Because I can make my money out of big corporate companies. I don't need musicians to make money. You understand what I'm meaning. I don't want to make money out of musicians. I want to help musicians to be able to look after their own rights. That's the main intention of Fame. If we can get with Fame to a position where we can purely educate musicians and they have the tools available to look after their own rights and their own interests, that's fine. If we can close Fame because musicians don't need us anymore, brilliant. And I'm so glad there's more and more people out there doing this. So yes, send it to us. It's what we are here for.
As a podcast, could we come to you for help in terms of developing a fair contract or fair agreements with the media and the artists that we collaborate and work with?
Yes, why not? Hey. It's related to music. It's related to the creative industry. Why not? Do it, please. We are here to help. Although Fame, we say Fame is focused on musicians, there are certain creative industries that overlap, like doing podcasts. It's there's so many similarities. You create like Audible content and you stream it over the internet. And whether the Audible content is a podcast or a song, it's slightly different, but it's there's so many similarities that we are more than willing to help. Look, we can help anyone. I'm just now focusing on Fame, saying that if it's podcast, if you're unsure, ask us. What we'll do is if we can't help you, we'll point you in the right direction. And the only reason we might not be able to help you is because at that given time, we don't have an attorney that has time to deal with it, or offer their time for free, and then we don't want to have you at a disadvantage. But that's why we've got that array of service providers, of friends of Fame that are willing to help. So come to us if you need help, and if you're creative, We'll either help you or we'll send you to someone who will be able to help you.
So basically what I want to ask is something that you touched on a bit earlier, bro, is that, you mentioned bands. For the majority of the creatives that we've had on the show are bands. You'll find that maybe people that listen to the show are people who are part of bands as well. So, just a question for them in terms of, how should we sort of set up, our band going forward when it comes to, the legal stuff? How do we go about who owns the music? Explain a bit more on that one there.
Okay. Well, what bands, or a lot of bands I spoke to didn't realize is by forming a band, you also form a legal entity known as an association. And it gets formed by default. It's a voluntary association of consisting of the members of the band. So you have a legal entity as the band. You obviously have the individual members being members to that association, but the band itself has a legal standing in its own right. What a lot of bands, especially the bigger bands, do is that they actually register a company, a private company, for this legal entity, and they list the band members as directors, which is, it's a brilliant way to deal with finances and contracts and things going forward, because now your band as a business signs the agreements, does the bookings, has a formal bank account for the band, and has its own proper legal standing. But the association as a band, it's just as effective, especially for starting out bands. You don't need a company. You can run as a normal band, but knowing that a band has a legal standing. And then you should definitely formalize this in an agreement or in a agreement type document where you say, guys, we are a band. The band is known as X. The band will consist of these members, but should one or two of the members fall away, the band can replace that. Deal with that in the beginning, not because you're going to fire a member or a member is going to quit, but should something happen going forward, should one of the members decide, listen here guys, I'm focusing on my family, you guys can go on wasting your weekends playing in pubs. I'm not saying it's a waste of weekends, I'm just putting an example there. But formalize it, state that these are the members, this is the band, this is our goals. Put goals there. So it's always good to know what you're working for. This is how we'll deal with money. These people are responsible for this. Or everybody is responsible for everything. Put it out so that you can say, well, at least we've got a base document that we can work from going forward. Something which we can reference, like I said earlier, have a reference document to go to should one drunken night we're like, yeah, you spend the band's money on liquor. And it's like, no, but we can. It's part of what we agreed to. Just it sounds silly, but just put things like that into an agreement or into a document, just so that people know exactly what they can do, how they can do it. What happens when you write a song? Does the band own the song? Does the individual members own the song? Obviously, when it comes to Samra and those things, you list the individual members and the band would be listed as the performer. I mean, that's a talk on its own. Or Samra, Dalro, those things. But just looking at how will we deal with the music? Again, when somebody moves, when the band breaks up for whatever reason, how will we deal with the music rights? Did we publish music online and now the band stopped? Who's got a right to continue that publication? And if the publication goes on and songs get sold, how do we distribute the money? Is it equal? Is it not? So it's things that you think when you start a band, now we're just starting a band, what the heck? But there are legalities surrounding that, because remember, a band is a business and you sell music. That's what it comes down to. You create music and you sell it.
Yeah, I think We've been in school today, so I'm very grateful for this. It's going to be, I hope it helps. I hope it helps a lot of people. Yeah. I have a question seeing as there is a little bit of history in terms of you being a musician yourself, what is Darker Colors?
How the hell did you find that?
You couldn't avoid this. I am the detective.
Well, after the band stopped, I produced some odd music. I experimented with music under different names. The first was Convict, and then I had an album out under Convict, and then I did Sound God, which had some music, and then I finally decided, okay, let me do it properly, and started Darker Colors as a experimental type thing because I'm classically trained originally in violin and piano. So I decided to do symphonic, not symphonic like synths, but symphonic orchestra type music, proper classical Baroque style music, but give it a modern twist. So include modern instruments, electric guitars, some synthesizers, and just play around with sound sometimes. I mean, I take a violin bow to a bass guitar, or use something silly like a box of matches and run it through a loop and a sustain pedal to see what sounds come out, and then make songs. It's for me to mess around with. It's not a 4-minute song. It's 20-minute music or sound experience, more like anything else. That's Darker Colors. It's me recording my sessions when I sit down, and then just like editing it and making it proper for future me to listen to and laugh again.
No, I did that. I think you shed a lot of light on that. You know, it was a very experimental thing, and I think, like, even for anyone who's listening, you explained it well enough that, you know, we actually want to go and listen now and find it. And your reaction to me was like, where did you find it? How did you find it? Is it like hidden somewhere? Is it not meant to be found?
No, because of my interest in intellectual property, I'm one of those guys, when I do something, I make sure that I own the brand, the name around it, all the social media handle, things like that, to ensure that should I wish to do something with this going forward, I at least have the brand to do it. So that's why I didn't think people would actually find it associated with me, because I purely just ensure that I have ownership of the brand attached to it. I don't know, maybe when the music is done and I think, I know this is worth putting it out there, and maybe somebody else might listen to it, I'll publish it and do it properly. But for now, it's just messing around. But that's on that point, that's another thing that musicians and bands can actually focus on, is monopolizing your brand associated with your band or music. They neglect that. You've got a social media page and things like that, but you don't have a trademark. So a third party starts printing T-shirts and capitalizes on your success where you could have done it. And now you don't have a monopoly in the brand, so you now need to fight a legal battle to actually use your own brand you built. That's why my view is always, if you do something, do it properly and make sure your brand is protected. And that's something that a musician should adopt, because at the end of the day, like I said previously, being a musician or a band, you are in essence a business selling something. And the only way people would know that this music comes from you and associates the music with you is through your name, and they therefore protect your name.
On that point there, how should, you know, the bands go about, you know, putting that trademark on their band and whatnot? Is it something that you guys sort of offer as a service as well?
Look, that's not something Fame offers, because there's financial implications on that, unfortunately. That's something we at Stain IP offer. And when it comes to things like that, where there's actually, unfortunately, a financial implication, there is cost involved. We have a set discounted rate for the creative industry at large. So there, it's not only musicians, any creative industry, be it literature, film industry, music industry, irrespective of what it is, we offer our services on intellectual property at an extremely discounted rate. So musicians can then, in that instance, come to us and say, guys, we want to monopolize our brand. And we have a couple of musicians that have done that. How do we go about it? And then we file a trademark for them in the relevant specifications that fall under merchandise and entertainment and things like that. And we structure it in such a way that it's still affordable to them. And we're always open to bartering. If a musician can't pay us, but they can offer us something of equal value and publicity, we like publicity, we're always open to that. So don't think you're going to have to pay an arm and a leg to get your trademark set up. I mean, trademarks, it's not as expensive as you might think. I don't want to put a number to it now because it's not as clear cut as it costs X, but it's affordable. And it gives you a monopoly for, in essence, indefinitely. In South Africa, if you get a trademark registration, it covers you for 10 years. And after 10 years, you just renew it for another 10 years and another 10 years and so on and so forth. So it literally gives you a monopoly in your brand if it becomes registered. And look, contacting us doesn't cost you a cent. So that's why I say, if musicians want to do it, contact us, talk with us. I'm a sucker for music. So we are, I always say, we are one of the few places where you can actually pay us with exposure. I know musicians, a lot of musicians say, yeah, we go to a venue and we have to play for the exposure, but we can't do anything with exposure. Okay, well, we will take that exposure that some venue paid you in, and you can pay us an exposure, if that makes sense. So look, we work with musicians. That's the thing. And we're always willing to come to the table and work something out so that their brand is protected. So yeah, please contact us on the Stain IP side when it comes to trademarking.
I think to make things a lot easier as well, we will leave the links to everything you're involved in the show notes on our post as well, so people can have easy access to that. I want to jump into a question that was sent through by the homies over at Casual Sex.
I love that name, man. It's
brilliant. Yeah, they recently opened up like a market. The very first in South Africa, in fact. And, you know, all these artists can basically go there and just monetize and sell. So it's a really cool initiative. And yeah, so they sent through a question, and the question reads, whatever happened to the governmental arts grant?
Yeah, look, we know of some artists that received it, although the red tape surrounding those grants, yes, they made it so difficult for most people for most upcoming artists to get any of those grants that I think it just slipped away. And it's the way they structured it. So they marketed it as, we give grants to musicians to help them through the time. But what in essence happened was, if you had a contract with a government service provider predating COVID that got cancelled due to COVID, you can apply to get a portion of that money that was due to you by government. That's what it came down to. Obviously, with some, like, that, not all of it, and there was exceptions, and some of the provincial governments actually made funds available, but on a different level. But at the end of the day, the requirements set by government for somebody to qualify for that grant made it inaccessible for the majority of musicians that actually needed it. So that grant, I want to say disappeared, but disappeared is the wrong way. In my view, it didn't even exist in the way they they presented it to the public. And whether it was done intentionally or not, I have no clue. But to me, it's probably steered towards they did not know what they were doing rather than they did something intentionally. Because working with government on so many levels before, I noticed they don't do a lot of things intentionally. They mess things up by accident, usually. So they made it inaccessible due to the requirements set for you to apply for this. So a lot of people applied for it, but they did not meet certain requirements. And then we also noticed that a lot of people met the requirements, but the application they submitted did not comply with the formality set by government, meaning they did not have a certified ID, for instance, or they did not have a proof of contract for this event they had. But me coming from music, and I'm sure you guys would also know, how many times do you actually have a state, like a proper contract between you and the venue that you are actually going to perform? Usually it's an email or something, and you pitch up and you do the show and you take the money. So they could not prove that the show was canceled because there was no proof that the show was there, although it was in existence and canceled. If that makes sense. So it came down to administrative burden, which most musicians couldn't meet. And that's why I did not have the desired impact on the music industry.
Looking at how you put it there in terms of, you know, artists didn't really have proof when it came to events that had initially been cancelled, would you say it would be, like a safe bet for bands to sort of, from now onwards, whenever you're booked at your local venue, draw up a quick contract and send it through to them, get that done so that you've got, you know, some sort of backup? But would you say that if government isn't involved at all, then you could literally just get away with, you know, the messages, the interaction, you know, the venue getting in touch with you, like, hey, you need me, would that sort of suffice?
No. Look, this comes down to, again, like I said previously, have things in writing before you agree to something. What I advise a lot of the clients we have, the bands and the musicians, is have a standardized agreement in your possession that you send to any venue you are playing at. And that deals with, we play, what's the date, who's responsible for what am I going to be paid? Or if I'm going to be paid in a fixed amount, or do we cut the entry, for instance, ticket sales. Have it in an agreement. Have an agreement in your arsenal that you, whenever you do a show, you give the venue this. Because remember, it also covers the venue. So most venues will be happy if you present them with an agreement. And it's something that you should actually do. Is if you do a show, irrespective of where, just to have, even if it's a 1 or 2 page agreement, dealing with what's the date, what was responsible for what, and how payment will work. And you can go as far as contingencies. If the venue, the event rains out, how are we going to deal with it? If it gets rescheduled for some reason, how are we going to deal with it? If there was expenses prior to the event, who's responsible for that? If there's marketing, who needs to market? Who's responsible to promote the event? Your contract should deal with those things, because then the more things you put down in a formalized document, the less things you have to stipulate and fight over later on. So it's irrespective of who you deal with, whether it's on government level or the coffee shop around the corner, just have an agreement type document ready. It also shows you as a bit more serious musician, if that makes sense. And it's something you should do. You don't need to use an attorney necessarily to draft something like that. You can set up something simple. You don't need all the legal terms to deal with who's responsible for what, the dates, marketing, money, things like that.
Yeah, I think a lot of musicians, or some musicians, might be hesitant or have difficulties in navigating that side of bookings, because that requires us to decide or creates a fixed rate. And that's something that I know a lot of people I've spoken to and myself have had difficulties with, because, you know, we don't want to undercharge and we don't want to overcharge as well. And yeah, there are just so many different logistics involved that we are not really set out or equipped to handle, because you know, essentially we wanted to make music and be musicians, and now we're like in all these different roles. So it's really amazing to know that there are organizations and brands and companies and people like you that are looking out for us. I would like to know a little bit of something about covers, because as I understand it, if we really would like to sort of boost each other up through royalties and passive income, then we could consider covering local music. But if I wanted to do that, I wouldn't know how to go about making sure all the royalties and rights are in place. So how do we make official covers?
It's not an easy answer in the sense that cover songs are difficult, because it depends on who owns the rights, and those rights, how they allow you to reuse their content and their copyright. And remember, music, it's not necessarily that one person owns the song. There's a lot of impact in that music and a lot of different individuals that could have copyright in certain aspects of the music. So you'll need to look at or consider all of those when you do covers. But I do agree we should start covering local artists, because if a cover song becomes popular, by default, the original artist would get money out of this when that music gets sold, because you as the original artist needs or legally would be have rights to certain royalties on a cover song. You need to take into account that not everybody, not one musician won't necessarily owns the right to its entire song. And there's different aspects to that, meaning somebody else might have written the song and this musician might have just used it, and whatever the agreement was between them and the original lyricist or the original composer and things like that. So there's a bit more than just simply covering the song, which you need to take into account. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't cover a song. The key here is give credit where credit is due. So don't if you cover a song, you cover a song, and you make sure that people know this is a cover of Prime Circle's original song or of Francis Van Cooke's original song, and you don't try and present it as your own, then usually you're fine. Look, you won't make money out of it. If you do a cover song, you do a cover song, and you rarely make money out of it. There's instances where you could, but generally speaking, the original, you won't be able to make as much royalties out of it as you would with your own original music. So that's on a royalty side, but I think where a lot of people miss or get it wrong is when you start doing covers and you post it on social media, like Facebook and YouTube, there's a different side of monetization associated with social media. The ad revenue running there, and if your channel or your video is being monetized, you get revenue from that monetization. Now, if you cover a song, and you put it in a video and there's monetization on it, then you might, even if you gave everybody credit, you did everything you had to, the monetization effect might still cause you to have problems. Take YouTube, for instance. The original artist gets notified through YouTube's brilliant algorithms. They pick up if there's a copyright issue, if two songs are similar. If it's a cover, their algorithms pick it up. And then the original artist or original owner of the original music, in most instances, especially if you look at overseas music, that's your big record companies like Universal and those guys own that rights. And they then have the option through YouTube to say, well, ban this song, meaning remove the music, or split the monetization, which I don't think a lot of people do. They want it for themselves, which brings us to the third option they have, is to say, allow the song, but all the monetization needs to come to me as the original owner of the copyright. So doing a cover song is one thing, but trying to monetize on that cover song is where you usually run into problems. And that's when you do a cover song. Now, what a lot of people miss is there's a difference between cover songs and parodies. If you do a cover song, you do a cover song. If you do a parody, you now change the original song to such an extent that you are actually infringing the copyright, because one of the copyright laws is you can't alter this, and I'm putting this in layman's terms, you can't alter copyright without permission, or copyrighted work without our permission. So when you do a parody, you are altering the original copyrighted work, and you could run into trouble. That said, not a lot of people have issues with parody because they're like, ach, no, it's fun. It's cool. And there's case law on this and what extent of parody is allowed. And it's free speech versus copyright and free speech versus other rights. And things. So it's a extremely debated area. But remembering that if you do a parody, the original owner can still say, this is copyright infringement, and sue you for that. Because if it comes to copyright, usually it's a dispute being fought in court. And if you do a parody on a song where the copyright is owned by Universal, for instance, they've got deep pockets. You're going to probably be out litigated because you can't afford the legal fees for that. So that's the two aspects. You've got cover music, it's fine. Just remember the monetization is where you can have problems. But when it comes to parodies, you need to know what you could potentially have yourself in for.
No, that makes a lot of sense. We're almost at the end, in actual fact, in terms of the time. I just want to ask a question, you know, about the cannabis cultivation and on Peter's rights. This is a fitting question. This is something that Megan nudged me and was like, dude, we need to talk about this, considering that our sponsor is Durban Poison Cannabis Lager. So I feel like this is the perfect way to sort of, you know, round it off. Tell us a bit more about that, you know, the plant breeders' rights and all that, because I'm pretty sure some of our listeners as well, you know, are enthusiasts. So, yeah, go for it.
Well, we, as part of our law firm and service we offer, is cannabis-related law, not criminal cannabis. So if you caught with too much dacha with you or trying to sell it, which is still against the law, we can't help you. We're more focused on the business side of things, where you can actually obtain licenses, R&D licenses to do research on that, or growers and export licenses where you could legally grow large quantities for export purposes or for R&D sales and things like that. That's the one side of it. And then the CBD industry, because remember, CBD within regulations are it's legal. So a lot of people started officially selling CBD products, like we all know, you get it everywhere. But when it comes to cannabis side of things, where you now get people selling cannabis, non-CBD based products, just buds and like you said, Durban Boys and things like that, you have to remember it's still technically against the law. You're not allowed to sell. The regulations state that you're allowed to have, to grow for personal consumption and to consume within your own private dwelling. That's fine. And there's limits on that. It's something like 6 plants or a maximum of 6 grams on you at any given time. Things I'm quoting from my head, so I might be wrong on those quantities. So selling and trading in cannabis is still not decriminalized, if that makes sense. That said, what a lot of companies started doing is they started jumping on the cannabis bandwagon for branding purposes. So they don't deal in cannabis or cannabis-related goods. They just deal in something associated with it, and they make it part of their brand. Like, there's many. There's energy drink like that. It does not contain anything remotely close to a trace of THC, but they call it something that invokes this association with cannabis. And obviously, I don't want to name any names because it's just not the place to do it. But you can, if you have a brand and it deals in cannabis-related products which fall within the allowed regulations or the allowed exclusions to criminalized substances. So I'm trying to say it in an easier manner, but if you deal in cannabis-related products that are not illegal, like CBD stuff, you're fine. But you must know what is still regarded currently as not decriminalized. And you have to steer clear of that, because we noticed that there's a lot of crackdowns being done on illicit trade at the moment, because government is trying to formalize it and regulate it and get to a point where the entire industry is regulated and to an extent legalized. But getting there takes time, and getting there, they need to ensure that people don't take advantage of the current situation. So you still have these immense gray areas where people take advantage, make a killing, selling, in essence, still illegal substances within the gray areas and loopholes that exist. So our firm is not against cannabis and proper and governed and regulated use of cannabis. Obviously, when it comes to illegal and illicit trade and things like that, we are against it because it's against the law. And if something is against the law, it's against the law. But we hope that the government will take advantage of the impact and the positive impact on the GDP a proper cannabis industry and regulated cannabis industry in South Africa would have. Because there's the end of it, if you can charge tax on cannabis, you win as a government. So why not regulate? And they know the value of it. I mean, they're busy with it. And there was the court cases talk to that, where they need to do this because it was found to be against certain laws not to allow people to have use or personal use of this. But you must still be aware of what the regulations are, what is actually allowed, because it's not across the board everything is now legal. Certain things are still illegal. And then also be aware of people taking advantage, because that is there. There's people going to take a hell of a lot of advantage of this gray areas.
I think that pretty much wraps it up perfectly, man. Please do send out your contact details for people to get in touch with you, your social media handles and all of that bit.
Okay. Simplest way is go to stainip.com or fame.org.za and find us on social media. It's at stainip and at fame.org.za. But like I said, go to the website, stainip.com, fame.org.za. All our contact details are there, and give us a shout. Follow us on social media and follow you guys on social media, because content is awesome.